So, tonight, I want to talk a little bit about intention, aspiration, and atonement. In Boundless Way, when we began each of our liturgy periods with the Gatha of Atonement, it's actually pretty unusual, especially in Zen. Sometimes the Gatha of Atonement is only done in a special ceremony that is done maybe quarterly, maybe monthly. But we do it when we're on retreat, we do it daily, and we do it weekly here. And usually that ceremony, the renewal of vows, is the renewal of our bodhisattva vows, the vows to save and serve and liberate all beings, the beings in the world, throughout space and time, and the beings in our own mind. The Mahayana Buddhist vow is to save all of them. And those are the four that's one of the four bodhisattva vows, to save all beings, to cut through the greed, anger, and ignorance that rise endlessly, to enter every Dharma gate, and to embody the Buddha way. Some translations of that last vow talk about mastering the Buddha way, but can't really be mastered. Nothing that you can grab and have and be set with. It's a continual process. And that process, and then there's also the precepts, the 16 precepts, the three refuges, the three pure precepts, and the 10 grave precepts, which we recited tonight. Those are kind of a expression of the intention and aspiration of practicing this path. As we were reciting tonight, the 10 great precepts. So following a tradition of a number of sanghas in the West, we do both kind of a positive formation of the 10 great precepts and a negative one. Traditionally, the precepts are only negative. They're only do not. And we don't even do the negative ones with do not. We just vow to take up the way of not. Which is a kind of much more forgiving and less easy to fail at kind of way. But so we also have that other side with each one. And I realized as we were reciting it today that I always take those things, take the positive ones as kind of almost like adverbial modifiers of the negative one, and like for me somehow it was clearly the negative one that is the real thing, and the positive one was just kind of the warm up to it, or the maybe a frame for it, and I think that in a sense it is a frame for it, but also I think that there's a way in which these 10 grave precepts, as we recite them, are actually 20 precepts. They're 10 grave precepts of do not, or take up the way of not, and they're 10 aspirational precepts. They're precepts of intention and what we aim ourselves at. And there's a way in which in which aspiration in general and practicing the precepts in specific and practicing the bodhisattva vows is like navigating by the North Star. You can look up at the North Star, you can see it, and you can let that guide you in your travels north, or even east or west or south as well. But you can't ever reach the North Star. And that isn't actually even the goal. You're not going north in order to get to the North Star, which would be pretty silly. And in the same way, just kind of aspiring and aiming is what we're doing with these precepts. So I just wanted to also just read the 10 aspirational precepts here. I vow to take up the way of recognizing I am not separate from all that is. I vow to take up the way of being satisfied with what I have. I vow to take up the way of encouraging all creations with respect and dignity. I vow to take up the way of listening and speaking from the heart. I vow to take up the way of cultivating a mind that sees clearly. I vow to take up the way of unconditionally accepting what each moment has to offer. I vow to take up the way of speaking what I perceive to be the truth without guilt or blame. I vow to take up the way of using all the ingredients of my life. I vow to take up the way of transforming suffering into wisdom. And I vow to take up the way of honoring my life as an instrument of the great way. And for me, that does a really nice job of kind of summarizing my intentions for me of how I want to be in the world, how I want to be with people, how I want to be with myself. And of course, I am probably unique here in that I fail miserably at all of the time. And so that's my aspiration, and I always fall short. But the practice of atonement is actually another piece of that. And I wanted to read this little piece from the teachings of the Desert Fathers, who were these Christian, a Christian sect some number of centuries ago. And the stories of the Desert Fathers are, they read exactly like Zen koans, to the degree that I believe that somehow, through some strange circumstance, they actually were studying Zen. It's just straight up Dharma, and Zen Dharma at that. So they were all called Abba, which is some language, including Hebrew and maybe also Aramaic, for father. The story goes that a monk asked Abba Sisoius, "What am I to do since I have fallen?" The Abba replied, "Get up." "I did get up, but I fell again," the monk told him. "Get up again," said the Abba. "I did, but I must admit, I fell once again. So what should I do?" The Abba said, "Never fall down without getting up." And there it is. Never fall down without getting up. What should I do? But what should I do? What should I do now? I just snapped at my friend. I just was completely rude to my coworker. I just got caught up in self-righteousness and or all of those things. So all of those, these are all ways we fall down. And then we get back up. We refocus onto our intention and get back up. And of course, Bodhidharma, the founder of Zen in China, says fall down 7 times, get up 8, which is obviously exactly the same teaching. And Dogen talks about, it's Master Munin in the Gateless Gate talks about 1,000 mistakes, 10,000 mistakes as a way to express this life of grace that we all are living right now. And Dogen calls it one continuous mistake, one big free fall in space. So, And this practice of intention and aspiration is a practice of being choicefully present in our lives, showing up in each moment of our life so that we can be who we intend to be who we mean to be, and then notice when we don't, whether we notice it right away or after a large span of time, to notice that we weren't being the person we intend to be, and then make it right to the extent we can, and again, aspire and intend to be the person we mean to be. And this is what we are practicing, literally practicing and training in the skill of with our zazen. It's precisely that. Our zazen is intending and aspiring to be present in this moment, to be right here following our breath, to be right here in the practice of just sitting untouched by human meddling, which is shikantaza. That's our practice. And then, of course, we move away from that continually. And that isn't a failure. The only way it could be a failure is if, like, the show ended then. But it actually doesn't. And that's what Abba Sisulius is pointing to, that each time we move away, and then we come back. We move away, and then we come back. Opening the hand of thought, coming back to the breath, back to the posture, back to just sitting. And it actually doesn't matter how long we just stay right here. It makes no difference in the world whether we sit for 25 solid minutes, 24 and a half solid minutes of having somehow no movement in our mind whatsoever. That isn't good zazen. That's not bad zazen. And it doesn't actually matter if, as soon as we bring our mind back, in the very next moment, it's caught up in anxiety and storytelling and thinking and congratulating yourself for sitting such a wonderful period of zazen, or whatever it is, that as soon as that happens, it's the going and coming back. It's this kind of dynamic equilibrium of movement. So zazen isn't non-doing in that sense. It's continually unfolding. It's our lives continually expressing ourselves and us strengthening that muscle of intention, of aspiration. The root of that word, by the way, aspiration, that spire, is Latin, I think, for breath. And that's the same spire of inspire, which is to breathe in, and expire, which is to breathe out. So that's another way we can describe our zazen, is breathing in inspiration and breathing out expiration. Or, in fact, expiring, dying in each moment, and then being called into existence by our aspiration, our intention, and then dying again and again. So, the Buddha actually describes this kind of process of continual movement in a different way. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, the Connected Discourses of the Buddha. "How, dear sir," the monk asked the Buddha, "did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straying, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straying, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and not straining, I crossed the flood." And that's also a description. That's a description of our the process of intending, and it's a description of our process of doing zazen. At no place in our zazen do we halt, and at no place do we strain. And there's nothing to strain against. There's no reason to strain, because it's just this, the entire thing is this act of coming back, of noticing, over there, right here, over there. And so there's nothing, there's nowhere in that to actually strain against when you're looking at it. So, but the other part of this is atonement, which is where I began with, the gata of atonement. I believe I actually looked this up in an actual dictionary, but somehow it is actually the case that the origin of, unless I'm confused, the origin of the word atonement is actually at one moment. And that's either true or true enough for our purposes. That's one way to look at it. It's being at one with our karma specifically, and being at one with all of the past moments that have brought us to this moment, all of the past harm that we've caused, all of the past unskillfulness, all of the ways that we've fallen and fallen and fallen, and that we've fallen and then not even gotten up and not even wanted to get up and then just lied there and wallowed in the mud and flapped around and it didn't even occur to us to get up. And being at one with all of that, recognizing that that is all part of us, that all of that is what has brought us here. And that's a practice of acknowledging, of receiving, and it's a practice of mercy and kindness and forgiveness for ourselves, and then recognizing that we're all of that past stuff, that past harm that goes into the beginningless past in ways that doesn't even have anything to do with specifically us, and then we fail also at forgiving ourselves, and we can atone for that, and we can again intend, aspire, aim towards that forgiveness towards ourselves, and then we find our heart is still hardened and small and tight, and that we're so critical of ourselves, and then we again atone and come back again and again and again. And so in that way, atoning isn't something special. And so there's a way in which when we say, now I atone for it all, that is the atonement. Now this moment has brought me here. And all of the past is in the past, and you raise the aspiration to act on your intention to be the person you need to be in each moment forward from now. And then you fail and you get back up. And then you fall and you get back up. The karma that has brought you to this moment, you can atone for, and you can also feel grateful for. It isn't just bad stuff. And the karma that moves out from this moment is your aspiration. And so what do we do when we fall? What is the practice of having fallen? And what about when we can't get back? What if we've fallen and we've broken our leg? There's a way that the beauty of this aspiration is, the thing about intention and aspiration, especially as we practice it in a Buddhist context, is it's not about what happens out there. It's not about what you can cause externally. It's not about outcome. its own. The entirety of the karma, the entirety of the practice is the intending and aiming. And because we can't control any of that. And that's probably just as well, because we're actually fairly miserable at knowing what is right for even ourselves, to say nothing of anyone else or the world or all of those things. And we don't know how it's going to turn out. And we can endeavor to the best of our limited abilities to follow these aspirational precepts, to practice compassion. And then the person who we're encountering, and being such a wonderful practitioner and being so compassionate and kind and understanding of them, and it makes no difference in the world whatsoever, they're still very angry at us and yelling at us or intransigently failing to do what we want. And that is fine too. And again, we practice doing what we can. And sometimes what we can is just to have that intention, even if it's not even clear to us what we do with that intention in this particular moment. Sometimes that is itself a big thing. And for me, one of the practices one of the things that I actually do in my own mind when I'm really like confused and conflicted and like angry or afraid or just like butting heads with somebody, I reflect on I don't know what to do here. What do I mean to be doing? And even if I can't do that, remembering what I mean to be doing is loosening. It gives a little more space. And sometimes that has a noticeable and palpable effect in the dynamic, and sometimes it doesn't. Or sometimes it does later. I've mentioned from time to time that I often have in my life struggled with depression. And sometimes when I'm feeling so kind of dark and muddled and depressed, and I can't actually figure out anything, what I'm going to do with my life, whether I'm a good, whether I'm good at my job, whether I'm being useful to the sangha, but any of these things, or even if I can't, on times when for a day or an hour or a week, it's hard even to get out of bed or something. But it's helpful to me, in addition to cultivating a capacity to just recognize that those are also just mind states, just mental dharmas arising. That's the form that my reality is taking right now in this moment. But in addition to that, I look at, so what is it that I can do? And so even amid all this confusion, it is my intention to be nice to my partner. Maybe I can make her a cup of tea. Maybe I can tell her I'm grateful for her. And sometimes to just look at what is possible, what is doable within the limitations of your karma right now, within the limitations of our own limited ability of what we understand, what we know, what we have the kind of space in our heart for. And sometimes we have a lot of space, and sometimes we have a little. But given the actual karma of this moment right now, what can we do that is in line with our intention? As I was trying to find that Desert Fathers quote, which When I successfully found it, I found it in the Amazon search inside this book feature of a book that I edited was the source that I was actually thinking of, and it was a really bizarrely circuitous way to go on about it. But I also I found as I was trying to remember the phrase exactly, I was Googling variants of the phrase, and it's all over the place, this teaching of falling down and getting back up. I was reading, one source I came across was it appeared to be a Jesuit sermon in which the person whose name I didn't record says, you may know the story in which an observer asked a monk what he and his brothers did in the monastery all day. He replied, "We fall down, we get up. We fall down, we get up. We fall down, we get up." And so we do. And as we do, we ask for forgiveness. We repent, is the word we use, which is the Christian version of atonement. And we endeavor to reorient ourselves so that we will fall less frequently, or at least not so hard the next time. Repentance has far less to do with hellfire and brimstone than it does with simply getting our lives back on track, turning around, reorienting ourselves to what God desires most, which has far more to do with mercy than with self-recrimination and punishment and fear. And the only thing that I want to add to that, he makes a excellent point where we endeavor to reorient ourselves so that we fall less frequently, or at least not so hard the next time. And that is also part of this reflective process of atoning and aspiring and intending to be the person we mean to be. And then the Buddhist take on it is that we also don't actually have to succeed at not falling so frequently or not falling as hard the next time. But again, when we do, when we fall over and over again in quick succession, when we fall so hard we like bang our head on the ground, that even then we again give rise, we cultivate the intention, we give rise to the aspiration to not fall in that way again. There's a story that I don't remember in entire detail. It isn't the same story that I always don't remember in detail. It's actually a brand new story. A guy is walking down a street and he falls into a big pit, and he's just so upset and so miserable, and how is he ever going to get out of this pit? And, oh my God, it's so horrible, it's just miserable, it's gruesome, it's awful. And then eventually, after maybe a couple of days down there just bemoaning his fate, he notices that he can maybe stack a few rocks and get back out there with a lot of effort, and then get out of the pit. And then the next day he goes down the same street, he falls into the pit again, and the same thing happens. And then the next day, after that, he goes down the street and kind of skirts the edge of the pit, and then he stumbles, and then he falls down. And then on the fourth day, he goes down a different street. And that's also kind of an expression of the way change happens or doesn't happen, and the cultivating of a more and more flexible moment of choice. It was that being choicefully present that enabled him to choose to go down a different street. And when there was a smaller moment, then he was able to accommodate and kind of skirt around the edge, or from the bottom of the pit, that moment of choice of continuing to wallow or to find enough stones to stack. And I want to close here with just a few lines from Lynn Jensen, who was the one who was writing about this. Does it follow? And he's a really fabulous writer, and I commend his three books to all of you. Lynn says this in the book called Waking Together Under One Roof. Falling down is inevitable. It's what we humans do. When I acknowledge this, it brings me to an unguarded kindness and sympathy. Falling makes us human, and if such a thing can happen, it makes us wise. Abba Sisolius is showing us that the trick of falling is just falling itself. And the only thing we need to do is get back up so we're ready when the time comes to fall again. That's all I got. I'm going to move into this space here. And perhaps someone might want to say something.
Let's say throwing myself against a wall in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And it hurts every time, and every time, predictably, I'm going to fall over and get up again and go do it and fall again. There's really not a lot that's helpful there after about the first three or four times. You know, like I should get through it. I can go around with that. And there's another way.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of reorienting or just realizing maybe staying down there for a while, you know, not being in any big hurry to get up.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And considering that perhaps there's something about the whole approach that isn't quite it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough just to get up and have at it. I'm just wondering what that aspect of it.
There's a saying, which I think might actually be from AA. That one definition of insanity was doing the same thing in the same way and expecting a different outcome. And so, you know, sometimes we have to fall those times in a row before we notice, oh, I'm falling every time. Maybe I should step over there. Maybe I should bring a ladder to this wall. Maybe I should you know, ask if anybody knows which brick I pressed to open the door in the wall. And to give, you know, kind and merciful space to ourselves to fall however many times we need to fall before we realize, oh, falling. And that's why and when we do, and then the times before that are the times when that moment of choiceful presence hasn't arisen, and then it does, and then it doesn't actually matter whether it happened on the first time or the 40th time, because in the moment that it does, we atone. We go by saying, yes, I just fell 49 times, and now I'm going to do that other thing. And then, with that intention, then you may fall again in a different way.
And there are also other ways to come at it and to look at it.
Right.
And I think of the story that you told before about the laying down, I think it was,
mm-hmm.
Throwing himself into the mud puddle or falling into it,
mm-hmm.
and his daughter throwing herself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's like, there's no problem here. And there's a kind of falling. I can see Lame and Pang would probably just go ahead and just keep going down the same street and falling in the same hole and being completely okay with that.
And laughing
it's
about
not a problem.
Yeah, right.
So it sort of depends on how you do it.
Right. And that's that the that's the 10,000 mistakes are also the life of grace.
Yeah. And maybe a third one, which is
yes, please.
Which is the learning to ride a bicycle model, where mm-hmm. you pretty much know you're going to fall over a bunch of times in order to be able to ride the bike, mm-hmm. and you can't get to that point where you're able to ride the bike unless you do the falling over parts. And even though each falling over is absolutely not riding the bike, it's required in order to be able to ride the bike.
Okay.
So when you finally are riding it, it's like all that not riding the bike is what got you there. And it's required and necessary. Those are the three things that come up.
Thank you. That was nice.
Sometimes you follow up with something and you don't know what orientation you have to do it differently.
Well, so it isn't. So the intention to do it differently, to get it right, or something, is a kind of very small and situational intention. So for me, and for me, when I am so completely baffled that what I can do is that my intention, however, whatever is going wrong here, my intention is to be kind to people.
Yeah.
And that might not solve that particular problem. I might not actually know what I need to do, but I can see that where I just went was a whole bunch of anger and aversion, and that isn't my intention. My intention is kindness, or one of these other, 10 aspirational suggestions that are things that may apply to a variety of situations that you may find yourself in. So the spiritual practice isn't itself about handling anything better. It's about working with our inability to handle them well. So it doesn't solve our problems, but it changes our relationship to problems, to falling, to not knowing what to do. It doesn't actually cause us to somehow have all the right answers to never go down the street with a hole. And that's where we can bring ordinary human wisdom and intelligence as well, which is part of it. Is there a circumstance you're thinking of in particular?
Yeah, there is. I have got some information recently that my brother is repeating the abusive patterns of my childhood in his own family. And I'm really divided about what to do.
I'm going to make an analogy to a much less intense and emotionally loaded thing, and then I'm going to respond a little to that. But for me, when I'm working on a book with an author, I feel like it's my job. The reason Wisdom pays me money is to tell them what is wrong with their book, and to tell them what the problem is. And to tell them, this doesn't make any sense, or this is obnoxious sounding, or you haven't addressed this thing, or that's a really horrible title you're very attached to, and we will only sell 14 books if we give it that title. And it isn't the case that I need to convert them each time. It isn't the case that I have to, like, win or have them agree that obviously in my wisdom I'm right. It's just that I need to have said clearly, this is not good and you should fix it, and the way you should do it is perhaps like this. And then they can tell me, oh, I'm not going to, I don't have time, I don't want to, you're wrong, you know, or whatever that these people who practice ego non-attachment, you know, often tell me. But I am not doing my job as an editor if I don't say those things and do what I can. In some cases, like titles, they actually can potentially cripple their book by giving it a bad title. So I have to do a little more than if they're giving something an excruciating title. I have to be a little stronger and more forceful and do it a few more times to kind of do my best to prevent that outcome. And if it's a difference between a good title that I'm suggesting and a good enough title or a barely good enough title that they really want, then that's okay. But I still need to do the best I can. And so in this really intense and complicated and really difficult situation, So how does our Bodhisattva intention to save all beings come to bear in that? And what is it that you feel you need to do or say to him, to someone else? And then to do that, and maybe do it again, and maybe do something of greater consequence. But what is it that your Bodhisattva aspiration tells you that you have to at least try? And there, then, and it isn't the case that we can always fix everything, even if we see what's wrong and problematic. And we have to be unattached to outcome, even as we recognize that it is very much a life and death situation. And so, you know, that actually makes me, this actually makes me think of the poem and the Gateless Gate. I think it's this fire. Kyogen's man on the tree. Kyogen is hanging by his teeth from a very high tree branch. And somebody, Kyogen is a teacher. Somebody comes up to him on the bottom, you know, 100 feet below, 80 feet below, says, hey, what's the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the west? And to do nothing is of no help. It's to not acknowledge the real heartfelt question that this person is asking. And to say anything at all is to lose your life. That's this muddy and complicated, and make clear answer kind of life. And I'd be happy to talk about this in a little more detail with you privately if you want. But that's the gist that I think you know. Get back up. And then get back up. And then when it doesn't feel that way, get back up. And get back up. Well, I mean, that's exactly, so I'm going to elaborate a little bit. That's exactly what this monk is saying. That's exactly what he's saying. So what do I do when I fall? He says, get up. I did get up, but then I fell again, and I fell back into my recriminations about my past. And I told him, get up again. I did, but then I admit. So each time, and so the other thing about fall down seven times, get up eight, there's actually just one time. Like the sixth time, the 4,000th time, there's just this time here, this time now. And to recognize that that your karma, your past karma, is such that this is where your mind goes. Repeatedly, this is where your mind goes. And to recognize that that is what it means to be you now. And and so all of these things, the not wanting to get back up, the really frustrating thing about it, the comfort, the certainty that you're that maybe you're falling because you deserve it and that you don't deserve to be walking upright. You know, all of those things, they're more forms that this moment can present itself to you in. That's just the form that the universal reality is taking right now. And the thing about the past, there's nothing that you, in a timeline kind of sense, there's nothing that you can do that's going to change that, because it's not here. But the thing that is here is this moment. And that's the only place you can ever do anything. And that, and the first thing you have to do when you come back to each moment is atone. And sometimes that is to acknowledge the reality of your guilt and your shame or whatever. Well, it isn't get up again. Get up now, damn you. Get up, soldier. So, get up when you're ready. So lie down there, nurse your wounds, apply a Band-Aid, feel bad for yourself, feel bad for the person you hurt, and then, when you're ready, not before, maybe never, get up. So you don't have to get up right away, but and you don't have to get up at all. Right. And really atone. And you can't atone once and for all, like in a fix-it kind of way, and then you're done because you're atoned. Atone continually. Atone in the way that you interact with people now. Atone to a stranger on the street. Atone to the rest of your family. Atone to them. And that's the way we practice it. And that, even as we are, you know, never able to get free of the ancient twisted karma that has brought us here.